New polls show that this year's race for Florida governor is still very fluid. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Former Congresswoman Gwen Graham is one of four major Democratic candidates running for governor. But a recent poll shows that she dropped behind Philip Levine and Andrew Gillum. We'll talk to her about gun laws, education funding, and climate change, as well as take your calls. Also today, we'll hear about reaction to the Pulse trial verdict in Orlando. There was a bombshell from the foreperson in that trial. And how big a deal is the James Beard Award? We'll talk with one of two finalists from Miami, Miami Herald food and dining editor Carlos Frias. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, an Orlando jury acquitted Noor Salomon, the wife of Omar Mateen, the Pulse nightclub shooter. That was last week. But shortly after the trial ended, the foreperson dropped a bombshell in the form of an anonymous statement. He or she said that the jurors believed that according to the letter of the law, they had to bring a verdict of not guilty. But they also said that on some level, they believe that Noor Salomon knew what her husband was planning. We're joined now by reporter Danielle Pryor from our sister station, WMFE in Orlando. She's part of the team of reporters who covered the trial. Danielle, great to have you back.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Take us back to that announcement of the verdict. I mean, what exactly, what was it like and what was the reaction? What did you see and hear?
Yeah, Noor Salomon was sobbing, basically, when she heard the first few counts of not guilty. And then her family kind of slowly joined her in that. And actually, some of her attorneys were also crying. But then on the other side of the court, you had families of survivors and families of victims who were just silent.
What have you heard from the community? Because when we talked last time, I got the sense from you that not really a lot of attention on this trial. And of course, because there's so many things going on right now, but I mean, afterward, what did you hear from the community?
Yeah, you know, there definitely wasn't throughout the trial. And then all of a sudden, there was this huge media coverage, you know, the New Yorker, the New York Times, and then the community coming forward. There were some very prominent statements made by Barbara Poma, who was the owner of Pulse. There were statements made by the mayor and even by Orange County Sheriff. And then we had, you know, Pulse victims and survivors outside of the Pulse Memorial on Friday. But directly after, when they were kind of released from court, again, they were silent in front of the press as well. I think people feel very conflicted about the verdict.
And now we have this news that the foreperson anonymously made a statement. What exactly did he or she say about what they understood that Noor Salomon knew?
Yeah, the statement I'm going to read a little bit of to you right now. On the contrary, we were convinced that she did know. She may not have known what day or what location, but she knew. However, we were not tasked with deciding if she was aware of a potential attack. The charges were aiding and abetting and obstruction of justice. So basically, the foreman saying that they knew that she knew something of Omar Mateen, her husband, the shooter's plans, but that they couldn't prove that she had willfully aided and abetted him and obstructed justice in that.
And in part of that statement, as well as they'd complimented, it seemed like I'd read that they had complimented that both the prosecution and the defense made good cases. But what kept them from finding her guilty then?
You know, the judge gave them instructions beforehand that they had to prove beyond reason that the charges brought by the United States government were true. And I think they really struggled with that when they saw lots of their testimony, lots of their witnesses being questioned, beginning with the fact that, you know, Omar Mateen and Noor Salomon had never been to Pulse before, even though that was what the prosecution had originally stated. And the fact that the prosecution knew this as far back as April, but didn't tell the defense about it. You know, I think it really brought the statement that she had made to the FBI into question.
You know, sometimes the way a judge charges a jury before they begin deliberations can have an influence on their decision-making process. How did the judge explain the law and the way that it should be applied before they went off into deliberations?
So they gave them a number of different instructions, some of which said that they couldn't factor in the fact that she didn't testify, that they had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt the charges brought by the United States government were true, that they had to consider all direct and circumstantial evidence, which included all the different testimonies, and they had to really look closely at the statements that she made to FBI. And considering all of this, I'm sure it was very difficult for the jury because, you know, these statements had really been drawn into question several times throughout the course of the last 3 weeks.
Is it just a case of there not being enough evidence to back up what the jurors thought to be true?
I don't think so. I think that it was the statement, and which they actually asked for another copy of, and their understanding of what aiding and abetting meant. And in fact, the judge wouldn't give them an example of what it meant, but he kind of redefined what aiding and abetting meant to be kind of this willful, helping, aiding of the husband in some way. And they found that they couldn't prove that necessarily using that statement, which, you know, Charlie Swift made a great analogy before they went off to make the decision, which is if you have a worm in your apple, you throw it out. And I think that's how they felt about those statements, is that they just were so questionable. How could they use that to kind of determine any other verdict?
A jury verdict in a case like this has to be unanimous, but we don't have any reason to think that there was a holdout. It sounds like the foreman is saying this was everyone's understanding of the law, right?
Right. That's what we're led to believe as well, that they were all unanimous in this decision, and that they, you know, just couldn't necessarily prove, that she had aided and abetted him and obstructed justice. You know, there was some testimony, too, given right before they made their decision that I just want to bring up, too. The prosecution found that actually Omar Mateen hadn't planned to commit the attack at Pulse, that he'd actually planned Disney Springs. At least that's what evidence shows now, that he had bought a stroller and a baby doll and was going to hide the gun in that stroller and actually attack Disney instead. So that was a huge determining factor as well, I think, because all the testimony had originally said, no, it was this premeditated attack on Pulse. And that was right before they made their decision as well.
Is it typical to hear someone from the jury come forward after the fact and say that they believe the verdict probably should have been different?
I think so. And in this case, I don't necessarily think he was saying the verdict should have been different. I think he made a statement just to the fact that he wanted to kind of explain the verdict as he had seen all the different responses from local community members. And it was really lovely the way he started out by basically, you know, talking about the families and the police response and just in this really unified way saying, you know, that they felt for the families and the survivors and the victims. But this was kind of the decision that they had to make based on their understanding of the law.
We've been talking with reporter Danielle Pryor. She's from our sister station, WMFE in Orlando. She's part of the team of reporters who covered the recent Pulse trial. That was the trial of Noor Salman. She's the wife of the Pulse shooter, Omar Mateen. And again, the jury acquitted her. Not guilty was the verdict. Danielle, it was always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
All right, coming up, we're going to meet another gubernatorial candidate. Former Congresswoman Gwen Graham joins us. That's ahead on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, there's plenty of time before we get to the election this year. We're going to be electing a lot of different people. One of them, of course, is a new governor. And the primary is still a ways away, but we have been talking with different candidates running for the governor's office, and today we're joined by another one. Former U.S. Representative Gwen Graham joins us now from the state, our sister station, WFSU, in Tallahassee. Congresswoman Graham, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, well, thank you for having me on, Lewis.
All right, what do you want voters to know about you that they maybe don't already know?
Well, first, I was born and raised in Miami, and proud to call Miami home. I am a mom, former PTA president, a school district official, and I served Florida in Congress. And I'm so excited about the opportunity to run for governor because every day I'm going to wake up and I'm going to be fighting for the people of Florida, fighting to restore our public education system, fighting to protect our environment, fighting to make sure that we have an economy that doesn't just work for some, but works for all in Florida. Building a new infrastructure in our state. I have spent time on I-95 sitting in traffic. It is time that we start investing in Florida and investing in the lives of Floridians. I want people in Florida not just to live here, but to have a quality of life here and enjoy their life here.
Now, you're obviously from a very famous political family in Florida. Your dad, Bob Graham, was governor and U.S. senator. But how much of a help has that family connection been in your own career? And do you ever have to fight the perception that your family is the reason you have a political career?
Well, I am so proud of all that my father has done for the state of Florida. And yes, sometimes I do know, maybe people are saying this in a little bit of a criticism, but to me, the example that my father set for public service is the example that I follow in. And anyone who's running for office and serving an office should have that standard as what they are committed to achieving for the people of Florida. And that's what I will do.
Again, I'm speaking with former U.S. Representative Gwen Graham. She is one of the Democrats in the race for the Democratic nomination. Again, we're talking with candidates running for the governor's office this year. We've got four main people here in the Democratic Party and a few more on the Republican side. We're going to try to get everybody before we get to the primaries. And if you have a question for Gwen Graham, 800-743-WLRN. That's 800-743-9576. What's the big issue or the big issues for you that you want to see the candidates tackle? Again, 800-743-9576. Congresswoman, in 2016, as you know, Democrats were split between the Hillary wing and the Bernie wing. Bernie Sanders, which side did you fall on?
I've always been on the Florida wing, and I got into running for office because I want to bridge the divide. I think there's way too much negativity in our politics today. I want to bring people together and so we can work together to make the decisions that are going to be in the best interest of the people of Florida. And that is my commitment. It's why I ran for Congress, and it's why I'm running for governor. And I know in Tallahassee, where we have had 20 years of one-party control up here, that we've got to have a governor who can break the hold that the special interests have in Tallahassee and the lobbyists and wake up. What I will do is wake up every single day fighting for the people of Florida, working for the people of Florida. I'm doing work days like my father did, which are the most incredible opportunity. Yes, you learn about the job that you're doing that day, but you build friendships and you build relationships. One of the last work days I did was at a Puerto Rican-owned grocery store in Kissimmee, and I spent the day learning about the issues that new Floridians are facing in Florida, like affordable housing, being able to get that job that allows you to make a wage where you can live on that wage, health care. We've got to make sure that we're providing opportunities for health care for all Floridians. So these are the passions that drive me in this race. And as governor, what I say, they're not just words. They're not just words. What I'm committed to doing for the people of Florida is what I will make sure we get done in Tallahassee.
You are regarded as a moderate. Is that accurate?
If moderate means that I'm practical and thinking through these issues in a way that we can actually accomplish the objectives that we set out, for me, governing is about finding a way to work together so that you can walk out of a room with a policy in place that's going to benefit the most people in Florida. The decisions that are made in Tallahassee need to be made with that being the guiding principle. What and how will this decision positively affect people's lives?
And you look at all the activism going on right now in your party, especially over gun control, the Me Too movement, Black Lives Matter movement. Is it a good year to be a moderate Democrat, or do you have to start to lean in a different direction?
There is so much engagement. I feel it everywhere I go. And these issues that have come up, the Me Too movement, gun safety, gun control safety legislation, which I am, as a mom, I'll tell you, when Parkland happened, I reacted viscerally because as a mom, I don't want any parent to ever have to drop his or her child off at school and worry, am I going to pick my child up alive at the end of the day? I come at this from a mom's perspective. I don't want to politicize this issue because if we politicize it, we lose what these students have started, which is a movement. And it's not a movement that should be made political. It's a movement about safety. It's a movement about making sure that every child can go to school, that everyone can go to a concert, that everyone can go to a theater, that can be out in the public realm and not have to worry, is there going to be someone with an assault weapon that's out to commit another mass shooting? So my commitment when I'm governor, and I'm glad we got something done, that was huge for the legislature who has been in the control of the gun lobby for the last 20 years to do anything. But what we've got to do is ban the sale of these military-style assault weapons. We've got to have comprehensive background checks. Right now, there are huge holes. You can go to a gun show, and you can buy a military-style assault weapon at 18 years of age without a background check. So let's do what we know we need to do. And again, this is not a debate about the Second Amendment versus common sense gun safety. My husband is in law enforcement. He and I have this conversation all the time. We can take these steps. It's what most Floridians want. It's what most gun owners want. You just have to have the political courage and the will to get it done, and I will.
Has your position on guns, though, evolved since the Parkland shootings? Or since, I mean, look, this has been brought up already in the campaign, something that you had said back in 2013, where you had said that, quote, I'm a very big supporter of the Second Amendment. Any law-abiding citizen should not have their gun taken away. And your opponents are throwing that back at you. But, I mean, has your position on guns changed?
No. I mean, I still believe in the Second Amendment. As I said, I think we are making a big mistake to allow this debate to break down a debate of Second Amendment versus common sense gun safety legislation. So I am a proponent of our constitutional amendments, but I am also believe and know that we must have common sense gun safety legislation here in the state of Florida to protect our schools, to protect our citizens, to protect our kids. And again, as a mother, I am not going to stop until we get the ban on military-style assault weapon sales and comprehensive universal background checks.
Now you talk about intelligent, or you talk about comprehensive background checks. You talk about common sense gun laws. What's your stance on, you look at, there are a number of cities right now challenging the state law that forbids them from passing their own local gun laws. If you're governor, would you defend the state law in court?
I have already issued a statement saying that as governor, that I believe that local communities should have the right to enact gun safety legislation and regulations that fit their communities. And I believe that the power grab in our state government makes no sense. It seems very hypocritical to me, because if you want government to be closest to the people, then you have to be consistent and allow government to be closest to the people, not just when you decide, oh, I don't want it now. So the preemption laws that have been put in place, which prevent local governments from enacting regulations that fit their communities, we've got to break that preemption law as well.
Again, I'm speaking with former U.S. Representative Gwen Graham. She's joining us from our sister station, WFSU in Tallahassee. Again, she is one of the Democrats in the running for this year's race for the governor's position. Again, Governor Rick Scott has term limited out. He is expected, of course, to run for U.S. Senate, though he's not yet made that announcement. 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. What are your questions for Gwen Graham if she were to be governor? What are some of the issues that are most important to you? Let me take a couple of calls here. I'm going to start with Kimberly in Cooper City. Kimberly, thanks for holding on.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Go ahead, Kimberly.
I just wanted to say that it's very nice speaking with you, and I've been in Miami for many years when your dad was governor. He used to come to our school and be principal for the day, and that was a
great
experience.
Can I come be principal of the day?
Absolutely. That would be wonderful. My question is about public education. I ended up going on, and now my husband and I both work in public education, and we feel that it's under attack from many, many sides. From the governor, who now requires us to contribute to the pension plan, which I was here long enough to know when that wasn't the case, and it was kind of a perk to draw us into the system, and then that was taken away, and Betsy DeVos and her attacks on it, trying to privatize everything. What specifically are your plans for our state and our public education system?
Well, Kimberly, thank you for that question. My passion is public education, and I worked in the public schools. I was honored to be able to do so for quite a long time, and my commitment is to get our public school system back on the right track. After I'm governor for 8 years, I will get a lot accomplished, but one thing that I am committed to doing is to make sure that every student across the state of Florida has the resources that he or she needs to have that quality education, that our teachers are paid as they should be paid. Teachers are my heroes, and they need to be paid for this important job that they're doing. They deserve to be paid well to make sure that we end. I mean, this high-stakes standardized testing that we see is doing nothing to help our students. We've got to put education back in the hands of our teachers. Let our teachers teach again. I'm going to make sure that we use, remember that promise of the lottery dollars? lottery dollars were going to add money to public education. Mm-hmm. And instead, what has happened over the last 20 years is that they have decreased funding for our public schools by almost 15%. I'm going to make sure that every student, no matter where he or she lives, gets that quality public education that then allows them to go out and get that great job. We need to bring technical training back into our schools. I think we need to bring it back as early as the middle school years. Let's line up the jobs that are available here in Florida, or the jobs that we want to have come to Florida. Let's give that skilled workforce that those employers are looking for. The next Amazon that comes to Florida, the next Amazon, it won't be Amazon, whatever the company is, I want them to look at Florida and not just consider Florida as a place to relocate, but want to be in Florida because we provide the best trained workforce, we provide a protected environment, we provide a non-discriminatory environment for all Floridians, that we make sure that we have a healthcare system that allows Floridians to get access to healthcare at a fair cost, and that we're giving people here in Florida that quality of life that employers want if they're going to move to the state of Florida. And as governor, that will be my commitment.
Kimberly,
as well.
Thank you so much for the call. Appreciate it. Let me get one more call in here before we go to a break. I want to jump over to Ricardo, who's calling from Coral Springs. Ricardo, thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you very much, ma'am, for taking this question. It's really an honor. So I understand that in Florida, there's kind of a big difference between how some Floridians view climate change and how others, particularly the governor, view it. I live in Broward County, and there are parts of my county which are literally already sinking into the ocean. What would you do as governor to address not only the issues that we're facing right now on the front lines of climate change, but to change the culture in Tallahassee with respect to how we talk about climate change?
All right, Ricardo, thank you for the question. Go ahead.
Ricardo, you've probably heard that Governor Scott has prohibited even the use of the words climate change. just because you don't say the words doesn't mean that we don't see the impact of rising sea levels all around the state of Florida. And I actually spent a full day in Broward County learning about the challenges that Broward County sees with rising sea levels and all the different water management processes that have been put in place. We're not considering the fact that they'd be dealing with a sea level rise of the significance that we've seen. So we've got to be doing our part in Florida. We are ground zero for climate change. So we've got to be doing things like making sure that we drive down carbon emissions wherever we can. We've got to join the Paris Climate Accord and meet those standards. We've got to be investing in solar energy. We are the Sunshine State. We should have solar panels on every single rooftop. And the way we do that is to break the lock hold the utility companies have on ownership of third-party ownership of solar energy. So we've got to make this something that Floridians find affordable. We've also got to make sure that we get people out of their cars as much as we can. I'm a Floridian. We very much are wedded to our cars. We've got to be able to provide mass transit opportunities that are actually convenient for people's lives. So these are all ideas that we as Floridians, we must see these put in place, because you're right. As the seas rise around us, we are the state most threatened by rising sea levels and climate change. And it is appalling to me that the governor of the state of Florida has not addressed this. It is your responsibility as governor to deal with the crises that face the state of Florida, to protect the people of Florida. One of my first commitments as governor is going to be to convene a commission of people across the state, the communities around the state of Florida, and Broward would be the lead, one of the lead in this, who are addressing this head on, and how do we work together with our local communities at the state level to give you the support you need to deal with rising sea levels.
Again, we're speaking with former U.S. Representative Gwen Graham. She's running for the Democratic nomination, in this very tight race. A lot of candidates running for the governor's post this year. She's joining us from our sister station, WFSU in Tallahassee. We're going to continue this conversation in just a moment. Again, the number is 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN if you have a question for Gwen Graham. More coming up. Your calls and with Gwen Graham just ahead on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, and I'm joined by former U.S. Representative Gwen Graham, again joining us from our sister station, WFSU in Tallahassee. And she is one of the four main candidates running for the Democratic nomination for governor. Before I go back to the phones, though, Gwen Graham, I did want to ask you real quickly. This has been in the news recently. President Trump has tried to overturn DACA. These are recipients, of course, under the Obama administration, children brought here into the United States that were given a form of legalization and at least a pathway to, and he wants to throw it out. And he's been tweeting a lot about it over the weekend. But, I mean, for you, as if you were the governor, how do you help DACA recipients? Or do you feel that if the courts decide that's it, then, you know, they can no longer have that protection?
I voted in Congress to protect DACA recipients and the Dreamers, and we have somewhere in the range of 30,000 to 50,000 Dreamers here in the state of Florida that are contributing to their communities and have lived in Florida and grown up in Florida. And to me, it is absolutely appalling what the president is doing, that throwing their lives into turmoil and having them have to live every day afraid of when they're going to be picked up or their family members be picked up. And we need to have a more compassionate government, a government that first and foremost thinks about the impact that our decisions make on the people that are here in the state of Florida and across the country. And I am such a supporter of the Dreamers. I know many Dreamers who are giving so much back here in the state of Florida. And the governor and the president need to work together to protect them. I understand that Governor Scott is a very good friend of President Trump. So use that friendship to protect the citizens here in Florida, please, and Governor Scott.
And you talk about what Governor Scott does or doesn't do, but if you're the governor, and this is still an issue come next January, would you go as far as, say, you see the activism of, say, a Governor Jerry Brown in California challenging the president and the administration? Would you go that far?
I challenge him today. He spends a lot of time, and President Trump spends a lot of time in Florida. I challenge him to look into the faces of these Dreamers and to not do what's right for them and their lives, to allow them to continue to be active members of our community and our society, and to care, to have a heart in this. I mean, this Twitter rage that he goes on is beneath the office of the presidency of the United States. And to deal with subjects such as DACA in people's lives in such a trivial way, again, is an embarrassment for the presidency.
All right, let me get to some phone calls here before we run out of time. I'm going to start with Carol in Lake Worth. Carol, thanks for waiting.
Thank you. Quick question. I've heard three of the four Democratic candidates. All of them would be a vast improvement over our current governor. But I would like to know from Representative Graham how she would distinguish herself from those candidates. So, you know, what would make me choose Representative Graham over Andrew Gillum or Philip Levine for governor?
All right. Carol, thank you for the call.
Well, I agree with your comment that any of us would be better than the current governor. And I'm friends with Andrew and have gotten to know Chris King along the campaign trail. Don't know Philip Levine as well. But I will tell you that my commitment to this race, it's about the people of Florida. And these are not words from me. These are actual commitments that I'm making. And when I get to Tallahassee, I'm going to wake up every single day fighting for public education, fighting for an environment that's protected, fighting for an economy where no one is left behind. It is appalling to me to know that almost 50% of Floridians are one paycheck away from bankruptcy. I don't know how Governor Scott can crow so much about jobs, 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 because for many people, they're just one job away from bankruptcy and one paycheck that doesn't make it into their bank account from bankruptcy. So we've got to do better as a state. And my commitment is to build a coalition from one end of the state to the other, from Miami, my hometown of Miami, up to the panhandle of Florida, of Floridians who know what they get with Gwen Graham is a governor that's going to wake up every single day and work hard for you. It's not about the titles. It's not about the pomp and circumstance. It's about being in a position to make a positive difference in people's lives. And that's what I'm committed to doing.
All right, I'm going to go to Cutler Bay now, and Robert's on the line. Robert, welcome to the program.
Yes, hi, and thank you for taking my call. I'm calling regarding a criminal justice reform and social issues that is somewhat sweeping this country and continent, and that's the issue of marijuana legalization. As you know, we have 9 states now that have recreational marijuana, including the whole West Coast, and even D.C. to some extent, and you have Canada about to legalize it. In Florida, you have polls ranging from 58 to 65% that support recreational marijuana legalization. Where do you fall on that issue?
All right. Robert, thank you for the call.
Robert, thank you for the question. I am a very, very strong supporter of medical marijuana, and I believe that anything that can be used to alleviate someone's pain, that we should not only offer it but make it accessible in an easy way. I'm disappointed with what's happened in Tallahassee, where they're again playing political games with something that the people of Florida overwhelmingly voted to support. I also know that medical marijuana can be a substitute for opioids, and we have a crisis in this state of opioid addiction. As for legalization, I think we need to make sure that we get this medical marijuana component put into effect and working well before we start talking about expanding it.
All right, let me get at least one more if I can in here. I'm going to go to Devin in West Palm Beach. Devin, welcome to the program.
Hey there. Thank you for having me. My question is somewhat related to the last caller's question, but perhaps a little bit more broad. I'm a public defender, and the number one voting issue for me is criminal justice reform. The vast majority of the people who are charged with crimes in the state of Florida are indigent, who, you know, are people who basically who can't afford representation, and in many cases, you know, criminal behavior is kind of a result of their indigency. I'd like to know what specific policies you have in mind that would address the high incarceration rate that we have in Florida.
Devin, thank you for the call. Appreciate the question.
Yes, thank you, Devin, and thank you for what you do as a public defender. I'm an attorney myself and have worked in the court system, and I have seen exactly what you're describing. We have got to make sure that every person who enters the court, the judicial system, is provided that quality representation that he or she deserves. We've got to make sure that we're decriminalizing. A lot of the arrests that occur are for minor possession of marijuana, for example, and we need to decriminalize these types of offenses and provide more opportunities for drug courts and other creative ways to keep people out of the justice system, the criminal justice system, because you're right. Once somebody gets in, sadly, it seems to be that there's a revolving door and you get rearrested and rearrested. So let's keep them out of jail and give people an opportunity to have a new life through more creative criminal justice approaches.
All right. Real briefly, just I want to wrap up on this. If you win your party's nomination, what's going to be your strategy against the Republican nominee? Is there someone in particular you'd prefer to face?
It doesn't matter who I face in the general election. We will win this election, and it will be an election about the future of Florida and the people all across the state of Florida. Again, as I said earlier, from one end to the other, that know what they get with Gwen Graham as governor is someone who's going to put aside all the politics that have infiltrated Tallahassee and all the special interests and just focus on how do we as a state help the most people every single day. And again, my focus is going to be on restoring our promise to public education, protecting our environment, building an economy that provides opportunities for all, making sure that we have an infrastructure support system in place, that we get people off the roads. Your quality of life is diminished if you spend hours sitting in a car trying to get from point A to point B. So again, it's about the heart in this. My heart in this is passionate about helping people. It's the only reason I'm running. And I feel very confident, without a single bit of overconfidence. This is hard. It's hard running for governor. But I'm doing this out of a labor of love because I'm committed to providing good governing back in Tallahassee for the people of Florida.
Again, we've been talking with former U.S. Representative Gwen Graham, running for the Democratic nomination, again, running for the governor's office. She was joining us from our sister station, WFSU, in Tallahassee. Congresswoman Graham, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, and I look forward to joining you in the studio sometime soon.
All right. Well, when you're back down here in South Florida, let us know.
I'll be there all the time.
All right. Still to come on Sundial. Well, it's the Oscars of the food world. We'll hear from another South Florida finalist of the James Beard Award. That's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. James Beard is considered the first true celebrity chef in America, and his influence on American cuisine was extensive. There's an award in his name, maybe the most prestigious in the food business. This year, two nominees for Beard Awards in different categories here in South Florida, Chef Brad Kilgore-Valter, and we talked to him. Also, our next guest, food and dining editor for the Miami Herald, Carlos Frias, and we spoke to him about becoming a finalist. Well, first of all, Carlos, congratulations on being named a finalist. When did you find out? How did you find out?
You know, it's funny. I pay more attention to the awards, the chef awards. So which we're going to be announced a little bit later in the day, like probably about an hour after that. So I'm just driving into work and I get an Instagram message from like a follower that I don't even know who the person behind the handle is. And they're like, hey, congrats on the beard thing. And I was like, I'd forgotten that I had applied for that. And I had to pull over. I had to pull over and be like, wait, is this legit? Is this happening? It was pretty exciting.
You know what? For people who don't know, I mean, who's James Beard? And I mean, this is a big deal in the food business.
Yeah, it's become, they call it the Oscars of, you know, Oscars of the food world.
Are you hitting the red carpet?
I'm
actually. Angelina Jolie joining you?
The Miami Herald has been nice enough to pay for my trip to go up to be at the awards.
Very cool.
You know, one of three finalists. They thought it'd be cool for me to be up there, and I'm super flattered and kind of still a little bit dumbstruck.
So this, I mean, this is a big deal. Who's James Beard, for people who don't know?
James Beard was basically the first celebrity chef. He was the first TV chef, so he predated Julia Child, you know? And so he was like, you know, Julia Child, Jacques Pepin, those guys owe like their start and their influence to James Beard. And I mean, really interesting guy. You know, he was openly gay. He, you know, during the time when, you know, it was like the 40s, you know, leading into kind of like the TV era. So he was, you know, on TV, and a lot of what we see today on TV only exists because of James Beard. He, in a lot of ways, he's also considered kind of the tastemaker of the American food industry. You know, he was like the father or like the grandfather of fine dining America. He was the first one to say, let's take our own cuisine, like American, quintessentially American cuisine, and raise it and do interesting things with it. And, you know, otherwise it could have been like, you know how we have this image of British food as being like, British food is not sexy, you know, like kidney pies and things like that. I mean, American cuisine is very similar. And he's the one that kind of like, you know, he studied abroad. He studied acting. So he was a guy who was tailor-made for being on TV, and he was this gourmand. So he took both those worlds and meshed them.
Thanks, by the way, for pretty much ticking off every British fan that we have of the show.
Oh, sorry about that.
That's all right. You've been in this position now, the food and dining editor for the Herald, for what, a few years now, right?
Two years. On March 30th.
Oh, it feels a lot longer than that.
It feels a lot longer for me too.
what's it been like for you? What's the journey been like?
You know, covering food is like covering anything else. I mean, I'll be the first to say that I'm not, I'm not a cookbook author, and I'm not a chef of any kind.
What, the Carlos Frias cookbook isn't coming out anytime soon?
Well, a lot of food editors are, and total props to those guys because they live it. Me, I mean, I was a sports writer. I was a general features writer, so I'm interested in people's stories. There's people who are great. Like, I covered baseball. There are folks who just loved the game itself, and I loved, the stories around the game. And I feel the same way about food. Like, there's people that love the game itself, the cooking and the nuts and bolts. And again, I like to cook at home, too. But I love the stories around the cooking, and I think those are the stories that I've tried to tell in the 2 years that I've been here.
Tell me a couple of stories in the time that you've been as the food and dining editor. A couple of stories that really jumped out at you that are your favorites.
Oh man, one of the ones that I really loved, we called it Farm to Chapel. There was a guy who he was born of a Muslim father, a Muslim Indian father, and a Catholic Italian mother, and he just kind of happened upon this Episcopal church in Miami that was financially right on the edge, but they were sitting on 5 acres of property, and the guy grew up with a real hunger and interest in farming, so he decided to start an organic farm on that church. And it's now, I wrote about it in October as it was just kicking off, and it's become a hit. You can now find his food at the Whole Foods in North Miami. You can find the kale that he grows there, and it kind of revitalized this older religious community. And he's he was very secular because he didn't really grow. He grew up with such different religious backgrounds, and I just to me it was just such an interesting story about so many cultures and religions and backgrounds and races, right, coming together on this one little community in this suburb in Miami, surrounded by houses. I liked that story. And it's one of the ones nominated for James Beard Award.
You know what? I wanted to ask you about, because I love the fact that you besides going and finding these fascinating stories, is that you have a lot of fun with your job. It seems like it, because, you beyond writing the stories, you do a lot of really cool stuff on Facebook and online. I got to ask you about this because I was just joking with you about the video.
Oh, yeah.
About the coffee video.
Oh, yeah.
And this was your idea. You came up with it from scratch and how you wanted to put it together. But basically, it's a how-to on, understanding Cuban coffee, understanding coffee in Miami. It was really cool.
Oh, cool. Thanks. We talked about doing a lot of the Miami Herald and also Miami.com, which, I also serve as the food and dining editor for our sister site. And I just thought, we started looking at doing things that are very Miami, things that are that everybody knows, but nobody has kind of put together as a cohesive thing. We said, we should do a video about what's the right way to order coffee and the only 4 acceptable drinks at the Cuban Ventanita. You go in and it's a cortadito, it's a cafecito, a colada to go, and a café con leche. Anything other than that will get you banned at the original Cuban Ventanita,
Listen, I really was just trying to get you to give me the hipster voice that you pulled on the video.
Oh, yeah. All right. Yeah. So part of the video, right, is that we made how not to order Cuban coffee. And we have a great video editor here. Her name is Chloe Herring. And she brought the funny to that. She added the little sound effects and she directed the shots and everything else. So if a shot looks particularly funny, it's because of her. I put on this terrible, Party City fake mustache, right?
Loved it.
The Peaky Blinders, hat and the black glasses with no lenses, and was all let me have a tall, non-fat latte, caramel drizzle, por favor. And I probably proceed to get thrown out of the restaurant.
Fastest way to get out. If you're going to be in Miami, drink your coffee the right way. The other thing, too, is that Munch Madness is coming to an end. Tomorrow it's over, right? So it's tonight the final votes?
Tuesday. The voting goes through Tuesday. Through Tuesday night at 9 o'clock.
Okay.
And then we will announce the winner on Facebook Live at around 10:30 a.m. on April 3rd.
As a reminder, by the way, this is the your version of the brackets of March Madness. It's Munch Madness. You started with 64, right? 64 different restaurants.
Right.
And people got to vote every round. And now we're down to the two finalists. Who are the two finalists?
Right. The two finalists are Tropical Chinese Restaurant, which is a mainstay. It's been here for 40-plus years in Miami. And then we have like a new kid on the block. It's called Bocas House. They started, they now, I want to say, have five or six restaurants. They're called Bocas House and Bocas Grills between Doral, Weston, Kendall, Brickell, Coral Gables. So they have lots of like restaurants and people potentially voting for them too.
What I thought was funny, so you told me about last year there was an issue with cheating votes. And this year, seriously, you had like what, bots? Do you have Russians involved?
We had the Russians are trying to steal our elections. They're trying to steal our Munch Madness.
Okay, what was this story? What happened?
Basically, what it comes down to is when you run a contest, again, the contest is totally for fun. Nobody wins any money. You win like this brass plate that we had made up, which is actually pretty cool, but it's certainly not worth cheating over. But what we had is so we run this poll online. You know, we run it through an online poll. And when you run something as an online poll, inherently, you open yourself to getting, spammed and stuff. And that's basically what we had. We can't prove that any teams cheated. Like, we will not drag anybody's name through the mud and say that they cheated. But we did get polls slammed. And sometimes two restaurants who were neck and neck, we saw, like, quote-unquote, irregular voting patterns.
Wow.
And we can't tell, it's for fun, so we're not going to get into, like, busting anybody's chops. But we had to, like, tighten up all our voting rules, our anti-robot, measures online. And it's crazy to me, man. And people get so into it. One guy who was the head chef of Dr. Limon, which is a Peruvian restaurant, and they have several locations, but they have one in Kendall and one in Miami Lakes. The guy, they got down to it, and he goes, he created an Instagram post that said that he would give away his car, his like tricked out Mazda Miata, if Dr. Limon won the whole thing.
Give it to who?
He would raffle it off to one of the people that that voted for them in the contest.
Well, okay, so there's something interesting to this. I mean, you keep saying it's fun, but at the same time, look, you get a lot of attention. You're getting a lot of attention for this, and so, I mean, if I'm a restaurant owner, I'm thinking, I want to get on this list, and I hope I make it far because, that's going to be good for me, right? I mean, that's kind of what it's become.
Well, I try to stress to people is that we literally have thousands of restaurants in Miami. So, like, when you get picked of one of the 64, like, you already win. Like, you don't have to, quote-unquote, win the tournament to win because you've already been highlighted. You get free publicity. We don't make any money off it because, honestly, we haven't sold not one single piece of advertising. If you go to miamiherald.com/Munch Madness, you'll be able to see the whole bracket, and there's not one piece of advertising on it. Like, I think we would like to work on that.
Well,
but
you have a guy who's willing to give away his car.
Dude,
that's how serious it's become.
It's crazy, and I can't explain it.
Well, does that concern you when you think about next year as you're preparing to do it again next year?
No, not at all. It concerns me that it stays legit, and we're going to look at different voting platforms to make sure we don't have to deal with, like, these Russian bots trying to steal our Munch Madness.
I like that. So right out of a James Bond movie.
But I'm going to do it the same way. I'm going to pick restaurants and talking to people that I think just deserve to be on the map, whether they're local mom and pops that are doing something really cool and something different and interesting, to like really fine dining places that you should have on your radar if you're looking for a nice night out. And I'm not going to be bullied by anybody who wants to be on the list.
What you're going to be announcing the winner, you're going to go, it's a Facebook Live, you're going to the place to announce the winner.
Yeah, so we'll either be at Tropical Chinese, which is across from Tropical Park in, I guess it's like south of Westchester area, you can call it in the Westchester area, or we'll be at one of the Bocas House locations. I think it would be their Coral Gables one is their headquarter one now.
Do you have a day that you're going to go?
That'll be April 3rd.
Okay.
We'll be live on April 3rd, we'll be doing the whole thing from one or the other. But where I end up depends on people's interest in voting.
So the votes are the polls are still open for votes all the way through 9 p.m. Tuesday night.
Right.
So there you go. All right. By the way, again, Carlos, congratulations on being a finalist.
That's right.
You know, just remember us when you become super famous. Waiting for the Carlos Frias cookbook to come out. If anything, your daughters will probably come out with a cookbook before you do, but that's okay.
Way before and much better.
And again, the Munch Madness, you can go on. We'll have a link on our website so you can go check it out if you haven't voted yet. You know, let people know which is your favorite restaurant to win this year's Miami Herald Munch Madness. Carlos, thanks again, man.
Thanks, brother.
Again, that was Carlos Frias, food and dining editor of the Miami Herald, one of the James Beard finalists over Miami. The award ceremony is in New York, April 27th. Good luck to you, Carlos. That's the program for today. Thank you so much for listening. Remember, find us on Facebook, WLRN Sundial, also on iTunes. Have a good one. We'll talk to you tomorrow.